Okay, yeah. Welcome everybody to the House hearing on Human Services and Housing. We are going to shake up the order a little bit because we have the honor of having our former committee member, Representative Neupeuler, here to talk about House Bill 2773. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2773.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. For the record, my name is Neupeuler. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend. It's nice to be back on the Human Services and Housing Committee docket. It's a committee I enjoy very much, and you do very important work.
Representative Beeler, would you like her to read a summary of the bill before you testify?
That would be wonderful.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2773 authorizes city or counties to designate vertical housing development zones within the jurisdiction until January 1st, 2026. The bill removes authority to designate vertical housing development zones from Oregon Housing and Community Services effective January 1st, 2018. The bill also specifies procedures and requirements for cities or counties to designating and certifying areas as vertical housing development zones. The bill clarifies the definition of rehabilitation to include cost of real market value repairs or replacement, and becomes effective 91 days following sine die.
Thank you.
Okay.
And members of the committee, I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2773. It comes to you as a committee bill from the Committee of Revenue, and there's been a number of unusual bills from the Revenue Committee, but this one, as a member, I can assure you, is a good bill. And it really tries to address the problem of affordable housing, which I know many of you in your districts and all around the state is a big problem and, unfortunately, a growing problem. To be honest, this bill will not fix the problem, but it's another tool and allow local governments to start to address this issue. The city of Bend, I have to really call out, is really successfully using a number of different instruments to try to stimulate affordable housing and just access to all kinds of housing workforce and just build the inventory. And they've done that with a number of local rule changes, including SCD relaxation for workforce and affordable housing, property tax abatement also for those sorts of housing. Accessory dwelling units have become very popular in Bend, and even rapid expansion of the urban growth boundary or inclusion of some property into the urban growth boundary in exchange for including affordable housing in that mix within the development. I see this House Bill 2773 is just another tool in that armament for local government to be able to stimulate the market to produce this sort of much needed housing. And it does it in two ways. It really incentivizes vertical builds, right? That's something most of us can agree on. There's only two ways to increase the supply of land. Either you can expand UGBs or you can build up and increase density. This is a bill that actually stimulates density, which most people in Oregon, I think, see as something we're going to have to do if we're going to provide enough housing. And the second thing it does is incentivize those vertical developments to include some aspect of affordable housing within those projects. So I think it's one of those bills that is creative. It's supported by many cities around the state, and I think it should be supported in a bipartisan fashion. So I'd appreciate your support, and I'd be willing to take any questions.
Any questions for Representative Beeler? Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
No, you've got a committee, another committee to get to, so that's great. Are there others who are signed up to testify on this bill? Are there several?
There are two others.
Only two others. So I think that we'll go ahead and take your testimony now then, and rather than make you wait to the end. If there are other people who are showing up at the end and would like to testify, we will reopen it at that point. But otherwise, if this is it, then we'll let you go home early.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. We'll hopefully be very brief. Chair Kinnegar, Vice Chairs Stark and Sanchez, members of the committee, for the record, I am Erin Doyle. I'm here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. House Bill 2773 is a simple bill in a complex package. The Vertical Housing Development Zone program has existed for over 10 years and has helped a few of the communities across the state to encourage mixed-use development or redevelopment to occur in specific areas within their city. This program has been used from Grants Pass to Gresham to LeGrand. In a nutshell, the way the program currently works, a city designates a specific area within the city limits as a vertical housing development zone in which any project which creates a mixed-use development and places housing on floors above commercial space can provide a limited property tax abatement that is tied to the number of floors of housings that are created or redeveloped. For each floor in the housing development, 20% tax abatement is taken from the value of the improvements up to 80%. If the development includes an equalized floor of affordable units, then an additional 20% can be taken can be abated off the land value. This program helps cities work to bring targeted, dense development to specific areas that they have selected in their comprehensive plan. For some communities, this is just as simple as rehabilitating a single building in the Main Street area to bring life into that area after traditional business hours. For others, we get large units, more than 200 units out of the proposed projects. Once a city designates the zone, they are required to reach out to other taxing districts to allow those other taxing districts to opt out of the abatement. After that, the city must reach out to the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department to have every project certified that it meets the requirements of the program. At the end of the day, this program has helped some communities in Oregon create denser housing options in a way that works for developers and the community. But when we worked to renew this program in the 2015 session, extending the sunset of the program to 2026, OHCS approached us to see if we would amend the program so that it would be locally certified projects instead of having OHCS do the certification. At the time, the timing wasn't great, and it made a one-page bill, a 15-page bill, so we asked for them to wait and that we promised to come back in 2017 to do just that. This is us fulfilling our promise. House Bill 2773 seems like a substantive bill due to the large number of pages and the discussion of the program, but really all it is shifting the final certification process from OHCS to the local government that certifies or that has designated the zone. This bill puts this local option on par with other similar local option tax abatement programs that has the local entity that adopts the abatement program to certify that the projects meet the requirements. This will simplify the process in getting any new projects certified under this tax abatement program, and therefore I urge support of House Bill 2773. I appreciate your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay.
Good morning, Chair Kinnegar, Vice Chair Sanchez, and Vice Chair Stark, and members of the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today. My name is Cheryl Tweedy, and I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Beaverton, and I'm here this morning to urge your support of House Bill 2773. This bill narrowly addresses the administration of the Vertical Housing Development Zone. This is a local option property tax exemption program that's very valuable to us local governments for providing dense, walkable neighborhoods and generating economic investment in Beaverton and cities across Oregon. Since the program was authorized in 2015, Beaverton now has three projects in the pipeline, either under construction or in the planning stages, totaling 352 new residential units in our downtown core. This is a much needed part of community development and our urban goals. These sites are also well served by transit. The Westgate project, which is our newest project in the pipeline, will be 230 units of mixed-income housing. It has both market rate and affordable units in this building. We, the city, have chosen to buy down the affordability of 15 of the units in this project. It also has 6,000 square feet of ground floor commercial space and is a stone's throw away from a light rail station. So it really hits all the bells and the whistles in our community about how we'd like to see our downtown downtown area growing. It's also well served by bus service. This program is targeted, a valuable local economic investment tool, and one that has attracted more housing and commercial development than the market would otherwise be able to provide. Local option property tax exemption or abatement programs, like the vertical housing development zone program, are typically and appropriately administered at the local level. There's ease for staff, there's ease for the developer by keeping it local. The genesis of the bill, as Ms. Doyle just described, was in 2015 when Oregon Housing and Community Services, which currently administers the program, requested that it be shifted to local administration when it was reauthorized. Given the timing late in the session, we all agreed to hold off until 2017, and that's the reason that we're here before you today to request this amendment through House Bill 2773. I urge you to pass it, and thank you very much for your consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you. I have one question. How did you buy down the 15 units for affordability?
Mm-hmm. We worked with the developer, and we worked on a pro forma, and we decided our goal was 80% of median family income. Basically, we took a look at the pro forma with all market rate rents and incorporated an alternative pro forma with 15 of the units at 80% income and came up with kind of the differential impact to the developer's rate of return. And then we, over a 20-year period, we did a present value analysis of that impact and ended up providing a little over $300,000 to the project to buy down the rents for a 20-year period. These are regulated rents that we've bought down, and at the end of 20 years, we'll reevaluate with the developer how those units will be priced in the future.
Okay, so just so I can understand, so you provided city funds of $300,000 to help the developers pencil out.
Correct.
Because you bought it down. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to that, there's a tax abatement of how much? How much is your the tax abatement?
It's in the application process right now, but we anticipate it'll be 80% of the improvement value.
Okay, great. Yes.
Yes, good morning. Just a statement, actually, that the city of Gresham is strongly in support of the Vertical Housing Development Zone program. It's been successful, and there's a letter of support from our mayor in Olas.
Great.
Thank you.
We have Speaker Kotek, who's just joined us. Would you like to ask any questions?
Oh, no.
I'm here to lurk. Okay. If there are no more questions, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2773. If there are people that show up at the end of the hearing today, since it's on the end of the schedule, we would be happy to hear their testimony. I'll now open an informational hearing on the preservation of affordable housing. I'm delighted that our speakers joined us. I know it's an issue she's worked hard on. So could we please have Margaret Salazar? And we'll hold off on Molly and Rob. Is that right? Unless you'd all like to be up at the same time. Okay.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark and Sanchez, and Speaker Kotek, and committee members. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I'm honored to speak to you this morning on the issue of affordable housing preservation. I will provide you some background on this issue, as well as some information on how our agency is working to address the need. This issue is near and dear to my heart, and it has been the focus of my work for the past decade, so I'm pleased to address you this morning. While we recognize the need to develop new affordable housing to help fill the rental housing gap, we also know that preservation must be a key component of an effective housing strategy. That's because nationally, we estimate for every one affordable home that's being developed, we are at risk of losing three, either to disrepair or conversion to market rate. In the 1960s, 1970s, and 1980s, the federal government funded the construction of thousands of affordable properties across the nation. These properties were financed with loans and loan guarantees from USDA Rural Development and the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. Most of them also included project-based rental assistance contracts. The contracts provide rental assistance from the federal government directly to the property owner, either a nonprofit or a profit-motivated owner entity. And under this arrangement, the tenant household pays 30% of their income toward the rent, and the federal government pays the difference between the tenant contribution and a market-based rent. Another portfolio of federal rental properties is the public housing stock, which is managed by public housing authorities through the Department of Housing and Urban Development. In addition to the federally assisted properties, we also have a portfolio of properties funded by the state of Oregon through the low-income housing tax credit program and other state investments. And we also have an array of local affordable housing programs in cities across the state of Oregon. These properties are also aging and have the same risks as the federal stock. So today, many of these properties are 30, 40, or even 50-plus years old, and they have significant needs and risks. First and foremost, they have repair needs, basic habitability and life safety issues, as well as significant major building systems, everything from heating and cooling, windows, you name it, including seismic upgrades. They have energy efficiency needs. These properties are not built to today's energy efficiency standards and are, frankly, bleeding energy, and those costs are hitting not only property owners but also project residents. They have accessibility needs. These properties were built before the Americans with Disabilities Act and before many of our fair housing protections, and therefore do not have the accessibility improvements needed for folks that are aging in place and may have disabilities. And aging in place has become a significant consideration, as many of the residents of these properties are elderly. Either these are senior designated properties, or the folks that reside in these properties have aged over time, and they need improvements to be able to input things as simple as grab bars to be able to allow seniors to age gracefully in place and maintain their homes. And perhaps most importantly, one of the biggest risks is that these properties have expiring rental assistance contracts and expiring use agreements. As you may be aware, when the rental assistance contracts with the federal government expire, oftentimes they can be renewed or re-upped. The owner is not required to renew that rental assistance contract, but typically it has been an option. However, when the use agreements on these properties expire, there is no ability to renew them with the federal government. Therefore, when the use restrictions that restrict either the rents or restrict the incomes of the residents residing in the properties, when those expire, that affordability protection goes away permanently. Even if the properties are not sold to another entity, they lose their affordability protections. So across the nation, as folks have begun to understand these risks, there has been a call to action on preservation. HUD prioritized preservation through a series of policy reforms to reduce red tape and facilitate preservation. HUD also provided technical assistance demonstration programs to help preserve the stock and empower nonprofits to be able to acquire and preserve these properties. USDA Rural Development is also doing work in this arena as well. In my work at HUD, I saw communities working across the country to prioritize and take action on preservation issues. The most successful efforts I saw were public-private partnerships that aligned data across federal, state, and local jurisdictions that helped to train and engage nonprofit organizations to acquire and repair the at-risk properties, provided resources for acquisition and rehab, and aligned funding and investments across all levels of government. Great examples include the Preservation Compact in Chicago, the Schimburg Center in Florida, the Furman Center in New York, and the California Housing Partnership Corporation. We have also seen tremendous work here in Oregon, led by our friends at the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing, who you'll be hearing from in a few moments. At OHCS, we are a steward of the hundreds of affordable properties that we have supported through the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program and other state investments. There's a growing recognition that in addition to that federal housing stock, the state-funded portfolio also needs attention as those properties begin to age and have a number of those same risks. That's why our agency is beginning to engage more deeply in the conversation around preservation, and we're working to develop a statewide affordable housing inventory that will include not only our state finance portfolio, but also properties funded by local jurisdictions as well as those federal properties. We are just in the initial stages of building that database. It will need care and feeding to be successful. As you know, preservation was a major theme of the recent Secretary of State performance audit of our agency. We agree that preservation is critical and that we have a lot of work to do. We think preservation is a cost-effective strategy, and we are looking for ways to engage on the issue. We've already included preservation in our affordable housing finance programs, including set-asides for various funding competitions. We've been fortunate to receive lottery-backed bond funding for affordable housing preservation in prior years. Last fall, we made $5 million available for preservation, and the governor's recommended budget includes a $10 million investment in additional lottery-backed bond funding, which we believe could preserve an estimated 200 affordable homes. We welcome further discussion on this issue and how we can continue moving the needle on preservation. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you this morning, and I'd be glad to take any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you so much.
Okay, next up we have Molly Rogers, Rob Presh, and Allison McIntosh.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Stark and Sanchez, and Speaker Kotek and the committee members. My name is Molly Rogers. I am the Director of Asset Management for Home Forward, formerly known as the Housing Authority of Portland. We own 6,500 apartments, all for low-income families and households, and it represents the largest portfolio of affordable housing in Oregon. There have been a lot of conversations about the need of more affordable housing at this time, and we need to do that, but we absolutely cannot lose what we've already built over the last several decades. Each affordable housing building has its own history, how it was built, who lives there, and who owns it. But most importantly, each of these buildings has what we call a restrictive covenant, which is essentially an agreement that the owner signs promising that we'll keep those units affordable for a set period of time. And when that period of time ends, the owner, we can choose to renew the agreement and maintain affordability or to opt out. As you can imagine, when the choice is made to opt out, that sparks incredible chaos for our residents. House Bill 2002 is designed to minimize this chaos and provide more opportunities to retain every affordable unit currently available in the state. Home Forward, as a housing authority, has been receiving federal assistance for almost 75 years to run a public housing program. Over the years, we have built almost 2,800 apartments with this resource, and they are home to generations of some of our community's most vulnerable people. Our average public housing resident has an income between $9,000 and $10,000 a year. They have a disabling condition. They have an average age of 55, and often they are a female-headed household. One of these residents is a woman named Trish Baker. She worked in healthcare for her life, and she now lives on a fixed income in our newly preserved apartment called Gallagher Plaza in Northwest Portland. Trish has lived there for 20 years, and she recently told us that her goal is to remain in her apartment for as long as she possibly can. After we went through a major rehabilitation 2 years ago, she told us that her goal is to continue to be a thriving community member in this neighborhood. She said, it's a wonderful community. I think it is much healthier now that it's been rehabbed, both for someone with physical and mental health issues, and it's also important that I get to stay connected with my neighbors. In our current rental market, residents like Trish would be paying all of their income towards rent if she was not living at Gallagher Plaza, or she'd be forced to move far away from her friends and doctors and healthcare providers. But now that the property has been preserved and financially stable, Trish and her other residents can feel safe knowing that the property will be financially and physically viable for the long term. Because public housing is one of the oldest programs supported by HUD, our properties are in some of the most economically advantageous neighborhoods, such as Northwest Portland, Sellwood, and downtown. These are buildings that could not be replicated today. buying the land and building them new, as big as they are for the populations we're serving and in these neighborhoods, just wouldn't be possible. If these properties go away, I don't know how they would be replaced. One of these properties is called Hollywood East. It's located in the heart of the Hollywood District. We house 300 elderly and disabled residents there, and they live within walking distance to grocery stores, to a MaxLine, healthcare providers, Providence Health System. And this neighborhood is perfect for this population. It was built 47 years ago, decades before Hollywood was one of the most sought after neighborhoods in Portland. It hadn't gone through any significant rehab until 2 years ago. And it was really with the assistance of Oregon Housing and Community Services and federal tax credits that we were able to do this. And the best part about it is that we didn't have to rebuy the land, which is currently valued at $5.3 million. Our oldest property in our Home Forward's portfolio is 105 years old, and our newest is 3. Like all homes, we need to periodically replace leaking roofs, repair failing siding and envelope systems so that we can keep enduring our Oregon rainy winters and improve the air quality of for our residents' overall health. We have learned over the years that a typical family property does need significant rehabilitation roughly about every 25 to 30 years, and that our mid to high-rise apartments can last a bit longer at around 40 years. But at that point, it can reach physical obsolescence. In the intervening years, we spend a lot of our efforts to extend what we call the useful lives of our major systems through preventative maintenance, selective repairs, and energy-efficient retrofits. It's always a race against time. And since our rents are restricted, we do need additional resources from time to time to stave off the inevitable deterioration. It's hard work, but the goal for us is affordable housing in perpetuity. Without additional resources and incentives for the preservation of affordable housing, I am worried how some of these affordable properties could convert to market, become unsafe, or need to be demolished, or be restructured to serve a higher income population. As we embark on legislation that will create more tools for preservation of what we've already built, we have to remember this is more than a physical home. We are really preserving inclusive communities and neighborhoods with services and amenities. We're preserving an ability to live independently for as long as our elders can. And we are preserving a crucial part of our safety net. We look forward to working with Oregon Housing Community Services and the legislature to build more tools for preservation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Stark, and Speaker Kotek. My name is Rob Brash. I'm the Preservation Director with the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. We've heard this morning about how important federal housing programs are for our state, for our communities, and most importantly, for the thousands of extremely low-income households who have an affordable home because of these programs. Here in Oregon, there are around 550 projects with project-based rental assistance contracts. You can see one in nearly every community from Coos Bay to Enterprise. Last year, these rental assistance programs brought a combined $118 million to our state. Project-based rental assistance is precious. Only one in four households who qualify for federal housing assistance is fortunate enough to receive it. Those households have average incomes of less than $1,000 a month, with many getting by on less. We know the market does not provide housing options for those living at these income levels. We also know that when a project-based subsidy contract is lost, it won't be replaced, which is why safeguarding these resources has become so important. Since 2007, the Oregon Housing Preservation Project has worked to preserve properties with project-based rental assistance. Mm-hmm. Oregon Housing and Community Services, the City of Portland, and NOAA, plus a dedicated group of affordable housing advocates, have promoted strategies to preserve our subsidized housing. Meyer Memorial Trust provided lending capital and grant funds to support advocacy work and fund energy improvements in preservation projects. And it was Meyer's investments that helped secure support from several other charitable foundations, including the MacArthur Foundation of Chicago, which awarded grant funds and low-cost lending capital to the project. Working collaboratively since 2007, preservation projects have preserved over 200 properties with 8,400 units of project-based rental assistance, ensuring low-income families, seniors, and people with disabilities will have housing options they can afford for decades to come. I want to call your attention to the project summaries that are in OLIS and then this map that shows where these preservation properties are located, and just compliment Oregon Housing on the work that they've done to really provide funding for projects in every part of the state. There's also lists of properties in each of your districts that are considered at risk. Since 2007, Oregon lawmakers have allocated dedicated preservation funds in every session of the legislature. These funds have helped fill project financing gaps, which allowed many preservation transactions to proceed. The state's investments have leveraged nearly $850 million in private capital sources and locked in over $1 billion in federal subsidy assistance payments over the next 20 to 30 years. And that's a pretty impressive return on investment of the state's funds. But we know there are still thousands of units across the state at risk. In fact, we know of at least 100 projects currently in a pipeline that have a preservation transaction that could move forward if only there were resources available. We estimate the gap financing needed for this pipeline of projects at over $100 million. Now, should the legislature allocate additional preservation funds this biennium, those funds could be used to help preserve three types of affordable housing that we've been talking about: privately owned rental properties with project-based rental assistance, aging public housing projects undergoing substantial renovations, and lastly, manufactured housing communities, which has always been sort of part of our initiative. We know that manufactured homes provide naturally affordable housing options to low-income housing Oregonians. There are over 62,000 homes located in manufactured parks in Oregon. Acquisitions of existing manufactured housing parks by mission-based nonprofit organizations or resident-owned cooperatives are both effective strategies for preserving these unsubsidized affordable housing resources. You've heard this morning that preserving existing affordable housing is good public policy. I believe House Bill 2002 is also good public policy because it will provide new opportunities for state and local housing agencies to preserve critically needed affordable housing in their communities. HB 2002 extends the notice requirement on subsidy contract expiration dates from 1 year to two and requires a notice of intent to sell a publicly supported housing project. When a publicly supported housing project is offered for sale, the bill provides a right of offer to Oregon Housing Community Services and the local government entity where the project is located. This right of offer may be assigned to a pre-qualified preservation-focused purchaser. The owner is under no obligation to sell the building. In this way, the bill respects the rights of private property owners. And I'd like to add that House Bill 2002 was modeled on a very successful preservation statute in Massachusetts, which directly contributed to the preservation of over 1,000 units of affordable housing through its first 5 years after it was enacted. And thank you for the opportunity to address the committee this morning. Pass it all, Allison.
Thank you.
Chair Kinney-Geyer, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Stark, Speaker Kotek, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance. Thank you for your time today. I'm just here to speak very briefly about the Housing Alliance's interest and role in preserving existing affordable housing and answer any last questions you have before you begin your public hearing on House Bill 2002. First, the Oregon Housing Alliance is a coalition of over 80 organizations from all parts of our state, and our members have come together with the knowledge that housing opportunity is the foundation on which all of our success is built. Individual success as students, parents, workers, and community members, as well as the success of our communities. We represent a diverse set of voices from residents, local jurisdictions, nonprofit housing providers, and organizations working to meet basic needs in all corners of our state. As you've heard from previous speakers, and I think it's important to reiterate, today we're reaching the end of contract periods for many affordable housing properties. As a state, we have the opportunity to reinvest in these homes by signing up for another 20 or 30 years of safety and opportunity through modest investment in these homes. An investment might be needed to replace a roof, make repairs to the exteriors of the buildings, or ensure the safety and habitability of these buildings for generations to come.
House Bill 2002 is a critical part of this effort. As these contract periods come due, whatever we as a state can do to increase information about these properties for communities is critical to efforts to preserve and maintain them. Preserving existing affordable housing has been a Housing Alliance priority since 2007. And before I go any further, I just want to take a second to explain why it's been a priority. Our coalition was founded on the belief that everyone needs a safe, stable place to call home, and our agenda always reflects that goal. Affordable housing is a key part of our community's infrastructure, just like roads, bridges, and schools. And just like those community assets, we need to periodically reinvest in affordable housing to ensure it continues to serve our communities for generations. We need to make sure we're taking care of the affordable housing built in communities across Oregon. Without it, people will no longer be able to live in the communities they helped to build, and we cannot afford to replace these valuable community assets. Since 2007, as Rob said, the public-private partnership of the Oregon Housing Preservation Project has helped over 9,000 families, seniors, and people with disabilities living with very low incomes to stay in their homes and their communities. And this was done through investment by the state through general fund and lottery bond dollars. The Housing Alliance is requesting additional resources to meet these needs in our community, and there are significant needs to preserve existing affordable housing with federal rent subsidies, public housing, manufactured home parks. An investment by the legislature is really critical to this effort, and the Housing Alliance is requesting $100 million this biennium to meet these important needs in our communities. We need to make sure we're taking care of the affordable housing built in our communities across Oregon. It is critical to our future. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. Are there questions for the committee? Representative.
Thank you, Chair Kenigar. Question for you, Molly. With the number of properties that you guys operate, how many of those units do you think are, let me back up. I visited one affordable housing project that I was very impressed with, but I was surprised when I found out that about 25% of the residents would no longer, if they were to apply today, would no longer qualify because their income had gone up, and they have kind of a lifelong housing policy there. And I was concerned because that took 12 units out of the 50 off the market for the very low income. And so I'm curious what, you know, for you guys, what is your policy on, you know, income limits, you know, moving people out, and if you do allow people to stay in beyond what their initial income entry limits would be, what percentage of your properties will fall into that category?
I'm not sure which property you visited. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
It wasn't one of yours.
Oh, it wasn't one of ours.
It wasn't in Portland.
So that rarely have we seen that level of incomes that have risen beyond the initial eligibility. I think what is important to just keep in mind is we do a range of income eligibilities that people have to initially qualify for. So it could be 30% of area median income all the way up to 80% of area median income. Most of our residents, however, vast majority, 80 to 90% of our residents, when they move in, are below 30% of area median income, and many of them stay within that income range. Every once in a while, we have residents who are lucky enough whose incomes do rise over time. We think that's a success for that community and for that resident. That's a good thing. We don't want to discourage incomes rising in place. And so we do not we don't force evictions in those instances. We do track over time, and we provide homeownership counseling. We help people provide and be able to move into a housing situation that better meets their income needs. So in our case, the number of residents whose incomes have risen so much beyond, say, 80% is I'd hate to even offer a percentage, but it's within probably less than 1%.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you. I think it was Mr. Prash. Just to confirm something, was it 62,000 manufactured housing units in Oregon?
That's correct. 62,000 homes in approximately 1,000 manufactured home parks in the state.
And are any of those parks, because I have a considerable number of them in East Multnomah County, as I think many of us do, and are any of those parks in one of these sort of situations where they're in a they're trying to hold the costs of increasing rents down.
Representative Gorsuch, Chair Kenny Geyer, the rents are not restricted in manufactured home communities. They're basically market rate rents. There are some provisions to use Section 8 subsidies just for the space rent.
Right.
So that you do end up having some very low-income households living in the parks, but the actual rents are not restricted by any covenant.
So, so we don't have like the Hollywood East or anything like that for the manufactured home parks.
If I'm following your question, there are parks that certainly of that scale. There's some parks nearly 500
units. But they don't
units.
Operate like what we've been talking about.
No, they do not. They're not rent restricted. Right. There's no income qualifying required at all.
Okay. The reason I ask is that many of those parks are extremely depressed, and we also have the fear of those parks being literally driven out of existence. So it would be interesting to see if we could additionally reach out to some of the mobile home parks. And I know, of course, money is always a factor, but it's certainly an issue for many of us.
It absolutely is, and the economics of it are making it even more dire for some of these homeowners. It was just this week there was a notice of a park closure in Portland.
Thank you.
If I may, Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Gorsuch. In the past, we've also used some of the lottery bond dollars from the state to help purchase manufactured home parks and make them affordable for residents. And there's a few models to do that. A nonprofit or a public housing authority could purchase the park and keep it affordable. Or in other circumstances, residents have formed a cooperative and purchased the park with some technical assistance and resources and kept it affordable for the residents as well. So that's another model that's been really successful.
And we can have a whole session on that because this committee has actually done a lot of work on making it more first right of refusal to the residents if they do want to buy it in a cooperative plan. They are very much part of the affordable housing rubric that we have out there. And so preservation dollars, home ownership dollars, any of the dollars that we talk about in terms of affordability, that is a piece of the puzzle. So there's been a lot of work that's been done on that by the Manufacturer Home Parks Associations and John Van Lanningham, and we can have a whole session on
that
at some point.
Thank you.
Representative Kenny Geyer and Representative Gorsuch, there is in the OLEX, there's a one-pager that provides a summary of a manufactured home park co-op and one that was bought purchased by St. Vincent de Paul and is operated as rental housing.
Oh, thank you.
I have one overall question. Two, actually. You talked about 550 projects currently. How many units is that roughly?
If you look at the combined inventory, including public housing with subsidized housing through USDA, Rural Development, and HUD, it's about 23,000 total units.
Okay, thank you. And then also in the approximately 100 projects that are up for renewal and need to be purchased and upgraded, and you were saying that would be over $100 million. How much of that $100 million is for the purchase of the properties, and how much of that is for the upgrading, roughly?
I don't think, sorry, Representative Kinnegar, I don't think I can answer that question. What we've gotten from the developers is an overall estimate of the total project cost and what their gap financing resources might be needed to do the transaction.
Okay. So the cost is actually far greater than that. This is just the gap financing.
That's correct. Yeah,
that's just is the gap financing.
Correct. That's right.
So there's a lot of other dollars on the table. This is the last part to make it happen.
Correct. And overall, these preservation projects, if we look over the history of them over the last 8 years, they run about two-thirds the cost of new construction. And the state's investment has been repaid more than four or five-fold just by the preservation of those rental assistance subsidy streams.
Great. Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the informational hearing on preservation of affordable housing and open a public hearing on House Bill 2002. Cassie, could you please read us a summary of the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2002 specifies procedural requirements for property owners participating in federal housing programs with expiring contracts, including notification 2 years prior to contract expiration and payment of replacement or relocation fees for tenants. The bill establishes civil penalties for violations of provisions and requires property owners of publicly supported housing to offer Oregon Housing and Community Services the opportunity to purchase property before third parties. The bill establishes procedures and timeframes for property owners to give OHCS written notice and for OHCS to respond. The bill also allows individual action to recover damages for loss of money or property caused by property owners failing to give notice or comply with expiring publicly supported housing contract procedural requirements. The bill clarifies and defines terms, including publicly supported housing, and applies to participating publicly supported housing properties on or after the effective date.
Okay, great. We are honored to have the chief sponsor, Speaker of the House, Kotek.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and Speaker of the House. And actually, it's an honor to be here because you're going to be doing really important work this session, and I'm guessing I'll be back more than once. So, but this morning we're talking about preservation in House Bill 2002. So thank you for the opportunity to start off on the public testimony, and want to thank the stakeholders you just heard from, Rob and Molly and Allison, and also the department for all the great work they've been doing on preservation. We face a statewide housing crisis that's really a result of lack of units, both affordable and market rate. And as I've said, and I will continue to say, to solve this crisis, we have to build more, preserve what we have, and also protect renters in the market. And I'm looking forward to coming back on manufactured home parks. There will be a bill, so we'll be back on manufactured home parks. But right now, we want to talk about preserving what we have. As you heard from the testimony we just had, it's a really important piece of the puzzle. We don't want to go backwards on the units we have now. And we have far too many people worried about where they're going to live. And the last thing we want to do is have those units go offline. I think you also heard it's somewhat difficult to assess how many units, but in terms of those at risk of conversion to market rate, the Secretary of State's recent audit of the department notes that 121 properties with 4,000 units have rental subsidies that expire over the next 7 years. And this is really a 5 to 7 year time frame on all of these issues, and that's an important number to remember. There are, and this is in my testimony on OLIS, there are an additional 72 properties administered by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development with 2,200 rental units at risk of deterioration due to age and inability to take on debt to recapitalize and renovate. The residents of those buildings cannot afford to lose their housing, and especially in this present market. So in order to preserve affordable housing and protect the public's investment in these subsidized units, we're proposing to strengthen current preservation laws with House Bill 2002. So the goal of the bill is to preserve subsidized housing that is at risk of conversion to market rate through the sale of the property or opting out of the contract. House Bill 2002 does three major things. It first applies laws regarding preservation to publicly supported housing, and you will see in the bill a definition of publicly supported housing, to define housing as subsidized with federal, state, or local resources. Currently, our law only applies to federally subsidized properties, and we have a lot of other public investment in these units, and we have to really discuss that. It's not just about the federally subsidized units. Second, the bill increases notice requirements for property owners who intend to sell an affordable property or get out of a contract. Current law specifies that an owner must give 1 year's notice. The bill changes that notice to 2 years. And I, you know, if you're talking about how we work in government, a little more notice makes some sense. Increasing the notice requirements enhances Oregon Housing Community Services' ability to track units that are at risk of losing affordability so we can better plan to support those residents who may be losing their housing. And third, the bill requires an owner to give the local government, state government, or an approved designee an opportunity to purchase the publicly supported housing in order to preserve the property's affordability. The intent here, again, is to prevent that affordable housing from going to market rate, and it's either for sale or we'll have an amendment to talk about when an owner wants to opt out of an affordability contract. I was going back and forth when we worked on this bill, whether it should be a right of opportunity to purchase or right of first refusal. Those are different things. One could argue in this housing crisis, perhaps we should go straight to right of first refusal on these subsidized units so we can make sure we are at the front of line. This bill talks about right of opportunity to purchase and some requirements for those notices as well. We are working with stakeholders to amend the bill. It's not totally right, no surprise. You're going to be seeing some amendments to deal with some technical errors, and I think you're going to hear some testimony reflecting some of those changes that are coming. We are going to have an amendment that will clarify the definition of publicly supported housing. Right now, the bill is not totally clear around Section 8. We want to clarify that Section 8 vouchers, standalone vouchers, are not subject to this law regarding preservation, but only place-based Section 8 projects would be included. We also want to specify that publicly supported housing includes multifamily housing with five or more units and excludes properties with fewer than five units. So we're clear about the scale of the properties we're talking about under the definition of publicly supported housing. There'll be an amendment to change the notice requirements, clarify that notice is triggered when a building is being sold without guarantee of continued affordability, as opposed to being sold with a new affordability agreement. I mean, that's really the issue here, not whether it's being sold, but to what, if it's going market rate or affordable. And then on the opportunity to purchase, the amendment will clarify that a designee is acting on behalf of the state and that the state is not legally liable when the designee purchases the building, something that someone said we needed to clarify in the bill. So we'll be back with an amendment. Again, I think you're going to hear testimony of that. I think I would be remiss in not adding a little bit here at the end about what it takes resource-wise. I would hope none of us would go away this session thinking if we pass House Bill 2002, we have solved the preservation issue in the state. We have been moving over the last 10 years around the edges to help preserve more units in fits and starts. $5 million here, $2.5 million there, usually lottery-backed bonds, some general fund. As you heard from the advocates, we need at least $100 million to really get ahead of this issue. And I can tell you right now, we don't have $100 million in lottery bonds. And often when we do bonding also, you're waiting 2 years until the next time we sell the bonds. We really have to get serious about this. The closer we can get to the $100 million mark this biennium, the better off we're going to be over the next 5 to 7 years in terms of preserving these units. So whether that's an increase in the document recording fee or some other resource or new revenue, we can't just pass this bill and say it's good. We need additional resources to actually get ahead of this issue. So with that, I'd be happy to entertain questions or I'll go back up there. Thank you, colleagues.
Questions, Vice Chair Stark.
Thank you, Chair Kennegar. Madam Speaker, is there anything in the bill, when you talk about giving the opportunity to purchase in order to keep it affordable, is there anything that would require a price in this bill that caps the price from, you know, any other market rate or anything like that?
I'd have to go back and look. I'm not aware of that, but, you know, I could ask my staff to clarify if she has a different answer, but I don't believe so.
The answer is no.
The answer is no.
Thank you.
You will see a bill that's going to come forward that came out of an ABC task force that you had named several years ago that gets at another issue, which is having a capital gains tax exemption when a property manager wants to sell to a housing authority or to a community development corporation. And that would help those nonprofit housing groups be able to purchase and would make this $100 million go further. So you will be hearing that. I think that bill just recently got dropped. Could be complementary to this and could help with the affordability and just gives leverage to the housing groups that would like to make a purchase and could offer a lower price, and it would be leverage. So I think of the supply, as she said, as we need to build more affordable housing, we need to preserve more affordable housing, and we need to make sure that private property so that what we have can stay, but also that's an opportunity to actually take private market rate housing and actually put it as well into the affordability. So another strategy.
Madam Chair.
It's going to take all kinds. Yes, Representative B.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Speaker, just quick clarification question regarding the right of first refusal versus the right to purchase. What is the difference of the one versus the other?
My lay, Madam Chair, Representative Meek, yes. My layperson's understanding is right of first refusal is literally that person needs to go to the public entity and say, you get to decide yes or no before I can do anything else. Right of opportunity to purchase is usually a timeline that says, you know, you get your chance, you know, a little quicker than the rest. But the right of first refusal is a lot harder of a trigger.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good.
And if I could just add, Madam Chair, I think this is also an accountability issue for government. When we invest taxpayers' money, in whatever form or fashion that is, through a tax credit, through a direct subsidy, whether it's federal, state, or local, these are our properties to some degree because of that investment. And so I think the degree that we follow what they, for example, have done in Massachusetts to make sure that stock stays with some public investment or at least a public covenant, I guess is the better word, I think is really important from an accountability standpoint as well. So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, colleagues.
So we want to be good landlords. Okay. Thank you, Madam Speaker. Next, we have Bob Wise from Lane County and John Bartholomew from AARP. Hi. Welcome. We have John Chandler after that. Would you like to come up and join them?
Nice. Me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, welcome.
I'm going to just start out with I've been very impressed with the complexity of this problem and the way you guys
can
have
you
been
actually
handling.
Start with your name for the record?
See what I mean? Daunted. I'm also daunted. But my name is Bob Weiss, and I'm a face of the problem that you're looking at. I'm somebody that rents at Yapoa and have been there for 15 years. And when I say I'm daunted, when you're talking about affordable housing, I'm hearing my home. I talk to a bunch of people from Yapoa, and they keep talking. Mostly the women talk about the safety of the place. I know I can be here. I know I'll be protected. The guys talk about how handy the building is. You know, it's got a lot of stuff in it. It's got a pool room. And they talk about that. But the safety issue for the women is really important. Some of these people are renting and living on $300, $400, and $500 a month. So I don't mean any disrespect. I hope you hear that I think you've got a very complex thing here. And I've heard a lot of nuts and bolts and facts and figures. And I keep thinking, if we don't get Yapoa up to scale by next year, I'm going to lose my home. That's what I keep hearing. If you guys can't work out a way that this can happen, I'm going to lose my home. And I know it's kind of selfish when we're talking about thousands and thousands of units, but that's thousands and thousands of people who are slightly worried about losing their home. Yapoa has been a godsend for me. It's just, it's got I'm one of the guys. It's my front yard is downtown Eugene. My backyard is the park. And when I take my dog out for a walk, it's like, you know, I've got acres to work. I don't want to lose that. And I think you guys can stop that happening. I don't quite understand how. Because as I said, and I'll end with this, as I said, I hear all these facts and I understand how complex it is, but I keep thinking about my house, my home. Thanks. Well, and I'll answer questions by saying I have the slightest idea.
An honest man.
How many residents are in there?
We have 222. We're the largest. Wait, I have a fact. I have a fact. It was given to me by the manager. We're the biggest senior housing building in Eugene. It's 222 people. or units, and 22 of those pay full rent, and the rest pay HUD for the HUD stuff.
Okay.
I answered a question.
Yes, you too. Are there any other questions? See if he's on a roll. Thank you very much for coming here
from
Eugene, representing all those students. I know from Representative Holvey that this has been a big concern, that they've been trying to find a way to make sure to stabilize the residents. So thank you for coming and representing them.
Yeah, it's tough to follow that. So. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Bartholomew. I'm the Government Relations Director for AARP Oregon. And we're here to testify in support of House Bill 2002 in principle, knowing that there's work that will continue to be done on this proposal. But we really feel like affordable and accessible housing is fundamental to the quality of life of Oregonians, particularly for those with disabilities and those who are over 65. Folks want to stay in their own homes longer. I think you just heard that. And the reality of a safe and secure and comfortable home for many families is in jeopardy due to this housing crisis. For people with disabilities and older renters, it is much more difficult to find another place to live for a variety of reasons. One is that they're often on a fixed income, and they don't have the ability to go out and find something that is market rate. Also, just their needs are different. Finding a place that has a walk-in or roll-in shower as opposed to a tub that they have to climb into, finding a place that has no stairs. This is harder to find. And then just the physical move itself can be extremely difficult. I mean, frankly, a lot of folks can't just, you know, if you're 23 years old, you might have a friend with a pickup truck or a van, and you call them and you get some pizza and beer, and you can make a move. Not so if you're 80 years old and you have mobility issues. So this proposal gets at some of this to, you know, preserve what we do have. And that's why we really feel like this is an issue that we need to have continued conversations about, especially because if we don't, some of these folks are already receiving Medicaid in-home care services. And if they're displaced, they may go into higher cost to the state long-term care services such as assisted living. We want to have people living with independence, choice, and dignity in their own homes, and that's what our long-term care system is founded on. And by not addressing this issue, we might be having higher costs in another part of the system down the road. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. Let me start with the fact that we absolutely 100% support the notion of preserving the affordable housing stock. We've had a variety of robust discussions over the last few years. We are going to have some more robust discussions this session on how to get more housing stock, affordable housing stock built. It would be silly, if not criminally silly, to let that same housing stock once built go out of affordability down the road. That just makes the problem that much worse. So I'm here in front of you with an attempt at supporting the concept of the bill with some concerns. I think if I'm talking to the Speaker's office, many of the concerns will be addressed, but I wanted to at least put them on the record since we had the hearing this morning. The first is, as I believe Speaker Kotek indicated, the bill right now applies to for-sale housing as well as for-rent housing, and the solution set for each of those in terms of affordability is vastly different. The bulk of the bill seems to speak to rental, and that's an area about which I'm not as familiar. I know on the for-sale side, big parts of this bill simply wouldn't work, which doesn't mean we shouldn't talk about for-sale housing continuing to be affordable, but it's going to be a different batch of solutions than what's in this legislation right now. The second concern, kind of on the detail of the bill, is on page one, lines, 24 through 26, the definition of publicly supported housing contained there is overbroad, frankly. And I think that's going to be tightened back a little bit, right? This doesn't even use the words affordability or affordable housing with relationship to any other contract or a government benefit. So as written, it could loop in SDC waivers, it could loop in fee waivers, it could loop in incentives for creating wetlands or energy efficiency or any of a number of other programs for which we provide some governmental benefit, tax or otherwise. That I don't believe that's the intention, and so I'm sure that'll be addressed during the amendment process, but I wanted to flag that for the committee, that if we're going to talk about affordable housing, we need to be very clear that is what we're talking about and not inadvertently affecting a bunch of other programs. Likewise, the resale restrictions notices, whatever they end up being, are also overly broad, because again, this relates to the for sale project. If one of my members, a builder builds a home, gets an SDC waiver, and sells the home affordable, who's the beneficiary of that? And who's the for purposes of providing a notice, if there is one, is it the builder who received the SDC waiver and wrote a smaller check to the city? Is it the property owner who purchased the house then getting the benefit of the SDC waiver? And that's just, it's unclear, and I'm not sure how it would work under this process. And I think I'd encourage you, as you're working on this, to recognize there are already programs in place that you don't want to back up over the top of. Portland has a very good SDC waiver program, for example, that only inures to the benefit of the first purchaser. That house then goes back into the marketplace later at whatever they get, whatever the market will bear at that point. That may or may not be a good policy the city's adopted, but if the legislature is going to tell them to do something different, it needs to be done thoughtfully, because that you would otherwise interfere with an existing program that's been pretty successful in the Portland area. Last point I'll make, and this is something we can talk about further, I understand that you have to have enforcement for any measure. The fining authority for OHCS seems a tad aggressive to me, but that reasonable minds can look at the same number and differ, I understand. But I think that's something that requires a little more instruction. And frankly, making sure the agency is up to the task of enforcing these rules once they're passed. There has been a problem, and we're trying to set up meetings to discuss that, of really nobody being in charge of housing policy in the state, because it's sort of split between DLCD, OHCS, local governments and whatnot, and that's probably a fairly inefficient way to handle a very important issue. Outside the scope of this bill, but to the extent that you're giving a direct sheriff on the beat authority to OHCS, that does loop in the implications of what that might mean for their other programs, staffing, budget, etc. As I said, we support the idea of making sure your housing stock continues to be affordable once it starts into the market. We want to make sure it works well. We look forward to working with the Speaker and the committee on making this bill go forward. We're glad to take any questions.
Good. Any questions? Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, good to see you. Thank you very much. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Bob.
Thank you. Really good to, I'm glad you're here to talk about your home. And thank you, John, from AARP. John Chandler, question for you. So I'm going to take this testimony of tentative support for a greater role from the state getting into local housing policy. So we'll we'll take that one.
That's how I heard it.
I'm sorry, my misinterpreted that. Just try. Second of all, since when we drafted the inclusionary zoning policy, it exempted single-family homes. So I guess one of the questions I'll just put out rhetorically and look forward to a follow-up conversation. So for those single-family homes who have had some level of public support, usually through SDC waivers, property tax abatements, or whatever, this is an ongoing problem of how we keep some of those homes affordable in the market. Because as you've noticed, as you noted, once the next sale happens, so I don't know if that's a support of a land trust model. We have to talk about that, because one of the spectrum issues here is we need to move people into affordable home ownership as well. And if we've made public investments to allow more affordable homes to be built, what do we do with that? So I'm just throwing that out there. I don't know what the answer to that is, but it sounds like we should talk more about that.
Madam Chair, Madam Speaker, yeah, that's an extraordinarily important conversation, and it really is philosophical. During the ABC work group a few years ago, it came up and was unresolved, because you know the SDC model I mentioned is one where it does reduce the price for the first owner, but not for subsequent. Habitat works on a very similar model. There's a variety of not-for-profit providers that have that model. There are others who then put in some that have a different philosophy and have different levels of recapture of the subsidy or the benefit over time. I don't know if there is a right or wrong. Absolutely. I think it is a good conversation to have, because you can, I think, make a strong case for both, and probably that both need to exist in the marketplace. so any legislation then has to recognize that you're going to navigate around those differences. Certainly nobody in this room is going to want to say that what Habitat is doing is somehow a bad idea, right? So you don't want to inadvertently then say you're changing the rules on the Habitat people, but on the other hand, it does create, I think, a philosophical conundrum, because if you're creating a windfall, it assumes that a very much higher level of affordable housing production if you're going to have the housing no longer being affordable downstream. But as I say, during the ABC work group, which was, for those of you who weren't around then, we met for a year and a half at the speaker's and Chair Kennegaier's instruction, and we talked about a whole bunch of issues and resolved hardly any of them because they're very difficult to resolve and they're very complicated with a lot of moving parts. That is one in particular that needs to be flagged.
This is a talented bunch, though. I'm sure we'll
can't wait.
Okay, great. Oh, yeah. Vice Chair Stark.
Thank you, Chair Kennegaier. A couple questions for you, John, and slightly outside of your expertise, but I know you work with the people who are the experts in this. One is a follow-up question on what I asked the speaker a little while ago. I don't fully understand the right of refusal versus opportunity to purchase. Your understanding of opportunity to purchase and that advance notice for, you know, local government and state government, does that in any way limit the market competitiveness in setting the price? Because I remember a day and age where, 3 days after a house hit the market or something hit the market, people are given prices higher than the asking price, trying to get in and get the first bid in to get it accepted and to get in on that. So if you give that first opportunity, does that limit market competitiveness in any way, in your opinion?
Madam Chair, Representative Stark, sure. Anything that slows down the sale process inhibits the marketing, and that may, that's not a thing you don't do, absolutely. It's just bear in mind that that is going to have a limiting effect. And since in a lot of markets in Oregon right now, Representative, we do have that competing bid backups and property marketed for X being sold for $10,000 over X as the bids come in. How will you factor in right of refusal? Certainly is a restraint, notice right or something else for OCS or anybody else. This creates I don't know how it would work. I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad idea, but it is something that isn't going to, it would have an effect and would be approached cautiously, I would think. But there are many, many gears intersecting on this. And if you're trying to keep property affordable over a long period of time, then you are by definition either relying on the same person owning it for a long period of time, because then the problem takes care of itself, or you're doing some sort of restriction on resale. And once you start doing that, then that has implications on a variety of other fronts that you don't necessarily need to not do it, but need to be aware of it.
I do have an additional question, but I think since the original question went to Madam Speaker.
Let's go back to Madam Speaker.
Yeah, now I've time to think about it a little bit. So just to clarify, the right of opportunity to purchase only allows a public entity to come in with a competitive offer to be, it incentivizes a competitive offer. A right of first refusal would be like, you got to take what, the city can offer, for example. So the opportunity to purchase allows for a competitive bid, but just make sure that we get in the queue too and can compete versus just going straight to the private market without us.
Is that it? Okay. Follow up.
One more question.
Yep.
Thank you, Chair Kennegaier. So in 2015, this again for you, John, probably in your wheelhouse. In 2015, when we were talking about the legislation to give a one-year notice, when these, especially the apartment complexes, were nearing the end of a 20-year or 30-year agreement with the feds, one of the concerns that people expressed was that if you give a one-year notice, then people will start looking for housing sooner, which is good for them, but bad for the landlord. If people move out with 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, until they sell it, and then that could be very costly for a landowner, because it's tough to all of a sudden, who do you put in a house when they know they have to move in 3 months or 6 months or 9 months? To your knowledge, have we seen that be an issue? And how would you forecast that, and what do you forecast that being an issue if there's a two-year notice?
Madam Chair, Representative Stark, I'm going to punt on that one. I honestly don't know. There are people that would, I suspect, that represent the landlords in the subsidized housing market more than I do. So I, rather than make something up, I'll...
We'll keep it as a generic question. I know there's
people listening. Well, we have one more person who is would like to say something, and Sean Jillians, if there's anyone else that would like to, do you want to ask a question of this panel? And we do want to move on because we've got another big segment on tax credits coming up, and I see Chris Alanek in the room. Quick question, and then one more opportunity, and this bill will come back with amendments, so we'll have further opportunity to discuss it.
Actually, I just want a small question for Bob. I mean, I know people are really, really concerned. Are people thinking, like, what's the thought process? Are they thinking, like, I'm going to have to move, like, really quickly? Tell me a little bit about rumor control.
We have several meetings of the people who are redoing the building, and we have monthly community meetings in the building where rumors like that are taken care of. No, you're not going to be thrown out. This is what we're handling. We have a team here, some of whom you heard speak far more eloquently than me, but they take care of those rumors because the fear can generate more rumors. And they've got a system now where if this goes through and we get the funding and they redo the building, they redo the building, the plumbing, the windows, they move us out and move us back in. They take care of everything, all the lifting, everything.
Okay.
One more thing, and they meet with us beforehand to see, these are things that have to go with me, these are things that can stay. So yeah, I think they do a really good job on taking care of that.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, panel. Okay, we've got one last.
I want someone to help us in the last.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Madam Speaker, for the record, Sean Gillian today representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. Reticent to come up and speak now that John Chandler has conceded that we want the state more involved in local housing policy. And Bob, you did a terrific job. Actually, that was excellent testimony. And I think not necessarily to the bill itself, but as we talk about housing issues this session, and Representative Stark, more to your question of what happens when you give these longer notices, I think we can all acknowledge that there needs to be better communication between landlords and tenants as we move forward. A number of the more high-profile issues that have occurred are due just to lack of communication and letting tenants know exactly what's going on. So I think, you know, unfortunately, I had the misfortune of spending 7 hours at Portland City Hall for the hearing up there as well. The emotions are very high on both sides as we talk about housing issues this year. And I hope that we can sort of step back and just look at the technical details of the bill. We do support the underlying intent of the bill. We supported the longer notice periods for these federally subsidized housing units in the past. If you all haven't looked on OLIS, Allison's got great sort of breakout of how many of these units are in your districts, and they really are units that we should preserve. Where we have a bit of concerns is this new definition of publicly supported housing and what entails that. I was happy to hear of some of the amendments from the speaker coming forward. You know, one of my first concerns was a Section 8 voucher, and you have an individual with a one-year lease. Now, all of a sudden, under the definitions of this bill, that's actually considered publicly subsidized housing. We wouldn't necessarily consider that. Shifting it to multifamily, only 5 units or more, that tends to make it a little better. I think, though, there's still concern about the broad definition of local government subsidies and whether or not we're giving incentive to build in an urban renewal area or if we're chasing that elusive voluntary inclusionary zoning and we've given a tax incentive to a developer to put more affordable units in and now we're getting a lot more restrictions on the tail end of when they're going to sell it. I think a lot of that can be addressed, and Madam Speaker, you mentioned it as far as what the intent was of preserving the affordability versus stopping the sale. So in a lot of these units, particularly in Portland, you have a 10-year property tax abatement, but you have a 30-year affordability deed restriction. So as long as the individual can still sell it at the end of 10 years, the affordability is still transferring with the property, but that's not necessarily something where we need to say, oh, you need a 2-year waiting period before you can sell this property off. As Mr. Chandler mentioned, giving the authority of an agency that not that long ago had a one-year budget cycle, $10,000 per fining ability is a little concerning to us. Not to say that there shouldn't be some enforcement of this, but that just sort of was a stark eye-opener for us, no pun intended, Representative Stark. We do look forward to working with Speaker's office, though, on the we do understand the underlying intent and are supportive of the underlying intent. With that, happy to answer any questions. Okay, the one I didn't answer. Right of first refusal versus offer to purchase. A right of first refusal basically is you have to go to the government entity or individual and say, do you want to buy it? Yes, no. And that's what the right of first refusal. You cannot offer it to anyone else until you've done that. An offer to purchase is simply, hey, we're putting it up. Here's our listing price. Here you go. Do you want to buy it? So they don't have to give a yes or no immediately. You just have to offer it to them, basically make them aware of the sale. With that, happy to answer any questions.
Okay, great. All right, sounds good. We do need to move on to the next issue because I understand Chris Alanek has to get over to Ag. So
no, let's stop
not
Chris
because of any interest in this issue.
No.
Thank you
so
much.
We don't need to talk about tax incentives for housing.
All right, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2002, open an informational meeting on affordable housing tax credits, and invite Chris Alanek, senior economist from the Legislative Revenue Office.
Members of the committee. For the record, Chris Alanek, Legislative Revenue Office. So I was asked to come and talk about the tax credit and provide an overview of the process. So for the new members, the legislature goes through a tax credit review process where all of the tax credits that are scheduled for sunset go through a review process. And simple bills that extend each tax credit by 6 years are drafted for each chamber. And the way the system works is that these extension bills are farmed out to the policy committees, like the Affordable Housing Lenders Tax Credit you have before you. And then the policy committee basically does a check-in. What is the purpose of this tax credit? Is it working? Does it need to be modified? And so forth. It's really a wholehearted review of the policy and the effectiveness. And then through that process, the committee determines if any changes are needed to it and then makes those changes as your deliberations continue. And then if the committee feels that the tax credit should be continued, it's passed on to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. And so there are about 15 tax credits that are under review right now in each chamber. And so there are parallel processes going on. And so all of the tax credits that get forwarded from the policy committees wind up in JTAX, the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. And then it kind of mirrors a ways and means process where generally the revenue chairs and the co-chairs and leadership talk about a budget for the tax credits. And then all of the tax credits that made it down to JTAX are kind of put together, and then it's a budgeting process for which credits get continued. And to assist in that process, the legislative revenue has been tasked with producing a tax credit report. The second report was put out this time. Last session was the first time. And so there's more detailed information on each of the tax credits in the report. It basically goes through. There's some overview of the process, and for each tax credit, there's a discussion of the policy purpose, a description of how the mechanics of the tax credit works, and then some other information about whether or not other states offer similar tax credits or other administrative issues, that kind of thing. And then there's a policy or impact analysis of the tax credit. So what I have here today, I have about 8 to 10 slides to walk through, and these are basically taking from that report. They're just some charts that were included in that report. So basically, what is this tax credit? For lenders who make below market loans, they get a tax credit worth the difference in the tax rate in the interest rate that they would charge. So, for example, if the interest rate for these loans is 5%, they can offer the loan at 1% and get that difference in terms of a tax credit. So, ostensibly, they should be indifferent, but they get the And so that's the incentive for the lenders to make the low interest loan. And there is a cap. It's a 4 percentage point difference. So the 5% down to 1%, for example. The eligible products include the construction, development, acquisition, or rehabilitation of a manufactured dwelling park, low-income housing, or a preservation project. And these loans must be certified by OHCS, and they administer the program, and they keep track of these loans, and they are responsible for all the enforcement and administration. There is a program cap of $17 million right now. That's in current law. And what this means is the amount of outstanding tax credits can't exceed $17 million. So it's not an annual cap. It is an overall program. It's kind of a revolving fund kind of cap. So if a loan is issued and the lender qualifies for a $500,000 tax credit, that's $500,000 of that $17 million. And one of the key aspects here is that the loan recipient is required to pass on the savings eventually down to the tenants. And that's a key aspect of this credit and the incentive. And it is very different from, for example, the federal low-income housing tax credit, which is a production subsidy, and that tax credit gets sold and can be used to raise equity for the project. This tax credit, the full value of that tax credit has to be passed on to the low-income renters.
Yes, Representative Stark. We'll ask questions as we go because it's technical.
Thank you, Chair Kenninger. On the $17 million cap, is that, I mean, first of all, have we ever hit that cap? And if we have, is it a first come, first serve? How would a lender know that as they're making this loan, do they have to get approval for it to go through knowing that there's still money, or is it, are they at risk of funding something at a lower loan and then not getting the money?
Chair Kenninger, Vice Chair Stark. First question, we have not hit the $17 million cap. We are close. I think at some, I'm not sure how far the deliberations have gone, but we haven't hit it, but we're getting close. And it's a front-end process, so they would know ahead of time. That's part of the administration of the Housing Department. They're the ones who monitor that cap. And
thank you.
I have a question also with the cap. So can you say per year how much tends to be given out in tax credits?
Yes, I have slides to both points. It's right now we're at about $7 or $8 million a year in tax credits that are being taken on tax returns. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the purpose statement, currently it's not in statute, but when it was implemented, I went back to the implementing legislation, and there was a lot of talk, and this was a response to cutbacks at the federal level. So that was kind of the backdrop at the time. We've gotten to the point in this review process where we're starting to go through a second round. And in 2011, there was testimony, I believe it was from the department, that stated, that summarized the policy purpose, basically is to support the development of housing affordable to households with incomes up to 80% of the area median income, the preservation of housing with federal rent subsidy contracts, and the preservation of manufactured dwelling parks. So this is kind of a key piece for the process. This isn't in statute. We do try to keep track of these purpose statements in the bill documentation, generally in that the Legislative Revenue Office produces. But this would be a key thing for the policy committee to review is, does this policy purpose make sense? Does it need to be refined? And is the credit achieving that purpose? Is it making progress there? And does that need to be modified? Do the mechanics of the tax credit need to be modified to further those purposes? So I'm not going to go through all the numbers here, but sometimes I often get a lot of questions about numbers. And this is an example. It's very simplified. But the point I wanted to make here, in yellow, we have a 5% interest loan. And so over the course of the loan, the lender would make $440,000 in interest. So that would be their income from the loan. In this, I don't know if that's orange or brown, but and so they get the issue the 1% loan. So this is the low interest loan. And off that loan, they would make about $80,000. The tax credit then is the difference. It's about $350,000. I'm using round math. But that's effectively, essentially what the tax credit is. The tax credit is taken in a declining rates over time, But the way the department administers the program, the rents are evened out over that time. So that it's a little bit different, but not getting to the mechanics there. But this is basically how the arithmetic works for determining the value of the tax credit. So here we get to the annual cost of the tax credit. So this this is the chair's question. I've gone back to the beginning of the program and tried to piece together data on how it actually affects the general fund revenue over time. And so the green bar, there's this concept on tax returns of credits claimed and credits used. Taxpayers are allowed to say, they're allowed to claim a $100,000 tax credit. They'll claim that on their tax return, and if they have enough gross tax liability, they will be able to use that full $100,000. But if they don't have enough tax liability, then they will only be able to use part of that tax credit. And then any unused part can be carried forward. And this particular credit has a 5-year carry forward. So the nature of the credit for any given loan, it's a 20-year loan, so it's a 20-year credit. And in any 1 year, if they can't use the full amount of that credit, they get to carry it forward for 5 years. So for the first decade or so of this tax credit, the lenders were able to use the full amount of the tax credit. And then things started to come apart, as everybody's familiar with, once we hit 07, 08, the recession. And the amount of the tax credits that the lenders could claim, they weren't able to use them all. They weren't having enough liability over that time period. And that's the separation here between the green line and the blue line. And so we get up to here about 2014. So this is the level of the tax credits. We're about $7 million or so a year that is actually being used to reduce tax liability. And the dashed lines are a current projection of the claimed and used for the tax credit over the next few years. So that's the bottom line impact. And then I have two slides on data that I got from the housing department. And so this is the number of affordable housing units that were put up, that were offered through this tax credit. It's not for all of the tax program, or not all of the housing programs offered by the department. This is simply this related to this tax credit, projects that utilize this tax credit. And the number of units that were assisted range from 400 and I think 03 to over 1,000 in 2007. So that varies by year. And this pie chart is kind of shorthand. It's the number of units or the share of the units by income group. And it's by shorthand. So we have the lowest income, about 10% of the units were for those with income below 30% of area median income. 11% for those between 30 and 40%, and then 37% for those between 40% and 50%, and so forth. So you can see the way the program has been used so far, the bulk of them are in the roughly 40 to 60% income group. Mm-hmm. And the last chart I have here gets to Vice Chair Stark's question and the cap and where we stand in relation to that cap. The purple line is the statutory cap. It's the history going back. It started at $1.5 million, and it has gone up over the years, and most recently increased. I think it was in 2009. It was bumped up to $17 million. And the green bar shows the number of outstanding credits. Now, these are estimates. I've talked a lot with the housing department, and setting aside some data issues, I've pieced together conceptually how this has looked. So the green bar is an estimate of that outstanding limit. So as loans are repaid, that creates room under the gap and under the cap. And then as loans are issued, it uses up that cap. So both dynamics are at work there. And the projection here, I just wanted to show that's just a simple 10% growth rate. That's not a formal forecast right now of the demand for the tax credit or these projects. But that shows how close we are to the cap right now. And that was trying to keep it short.
Yep.
Those were the highlights, and these were all just taken from the report. I don't know if that's in OLIS for this committee. It is on the LRO website.
Yes.
And as a resource, LRR, we are, as part of this process, we are available to the committee and members as you have any questions or would like additional work done.
That's great. That's great. Thank you. I think Vice Chair Stark, you have a question.
Thank you, Chair Kindergarten. On the, just a clarification, when you say affordable housing units, is that, is a unit a household, is a unit a bedroom, is a, how is the unit defined?
I believe it's the apartment.
So the
building.
So, no, so the building?
No, the household.
Yeah,
I mean, a building could have 5 units or 10 units.
Okay, so it, it's assumed a household, though.
If one, just, if there's one house,
just because a unit can be a one bed or a 5-bedroom house. I'm just trying to make sure I understand it.
I believe it's just whatever. It could be a one bed, one bedroom or a 2-bedroom, okay. For example.
So just for a small apartment.
Correct.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here, Chris. So on the intent around loan recipients required to pass on the savings to tenants in the form of reduced housing payments, and maybe this is a question for the agency, how is that monitored? How are we holding folks accountable to meeting that goal? Maybe that's a further conversation, but I
think the housing department is best suited to answer. That is part of their administration. I did have conversations with them. About the detail. There's a lot of paperwork, and they're checking in with the lenders and the project owners. So, but they, I would, wouldn't want to hazard a guess.
Okay.
The department can answer that one directly.
Okay.
Great. Okay, so we've got 3 people signed up to testify, and they may be able to answer that. And if we have time, we'll get to the director of OHCS. And I do want to know, thank you so much, Chris.
Sure.
I know you have to get on to agriculture. There was a bill 2070 that we were discussing that was referred to us by revenue. There's also a bill that did not make it in time to be posted for today, but when we come back to visit this again, we will be revisiting 2070 along with House Bill 2852, which is a bill presented, personal bill presented by several members that also has to do with this tax credit. So this was more of an introduction so you understand. This is one of the very few sources of funding that we have to create new affordable housing, along with the document recording fee, are really the only 2 state-generated funding sources that we have. And so they're very, very important. And this is preservation is one of the great needs we have. This is one of the opportunities to fund it. Fund preservation and other. And so think of it, it's a very complicated area. Chris has been great at coming to your office if you really want to sit down and try to understand it. Mm. And we will revisit both bills at once next time around. So please can we have Allison McIntosh, Bill Van Vliet, and Jessica Woodruff. Oh, I've got to close. Thank you. Close the informational hearing and open the public hearing on House Bill 2070.
Chair Kindergarten, Vice Chair Sanchez, Vice Chair Stark, Speaker Kotek, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance. I'm going to try to be brief so we can let the real experts talk. But I just wanted to give a little bit of background about the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit as well as the need for more affordable housing. As I said earlier, the Housing Alliance is a coalition that came together with the knowledge that we all need a safe, stable, affordable place to call home. And today we simply don't have enough affordable homes to meet the need for across our communities. 1 in 4 renters in Oregon pay more than half of their income towards rent, leaving too little money left over for basic necessities like food, medicine, and utilities. We need additional resources and tools to build more safe, stable, and affordable housing across Oregon. So included in OLIS today, we have a few things. We've submitted our Housing Alliance County Need Sheets, which try to give a picture of housing costs versus wages in every county in the state. We've kind of submitted some of the counties that your districts include, and all 36 counties are available on our website. We also submitted, with some expert help, we drafted some background information on the credit in response to the questions posed by the Joint Tax Credit Committee. That document also includes a map of the locations where these projects have been funded with this tax credit over since inception. And then we also submitted, based on some information publicly available from Oregon Housing and Community Services, a list of all of the projects funded over time by county. So it should be some good background information in OLIS for you. So for people with the lowest incomes, the private market simply does not provide enough affordable housing to meet demand. And over time, local, state, and federal governments have built systems and structures necessary to provide this needed affordable housing. And those efforts have been very successful at building thousands of units across Oregon, but we have not yet met the need for this type of housing. We do know how to build this housing in communities. We simply don't have enough resources to meet demand. So today we're here to tell you about one of those resources. It's a very successful, effective tool, the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. It's a state tax credit that has many benefits, including developing and preserving affordable housing, directly benefiting residents and encouraging the involvement of private lenders in affordable housing. As you heard from Chris, with all state tax credits, the credit is scheduled to sunset every 6 years so that it can be reviewed by the legislature to ensure it continues to be an effective tool to meet its purpose. House Bill 2070, which we're here today to speak about, simply extends the sunset on the credit for an additional 6 years. Before I turn it over to our experts, I do thank you, Chair Kinninger, for mentioning we do have a bill, House Bill 2852, which both extends the sunset and expands the credit. And we'll be back to share with you more about what might be possible if we were able to expand the credit. So thank you very much for your time this morning, and I turn it over to Bill.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Kinninger, Vice Chair Sanchez and Stark, and Speaker Kotek, members of the committee. My name is Bill Van Vliet. I am the Executive Director with NOAA, the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. And NOAA is a statewide nonprofit that provides a variety of financing programs for low-income housing, multifamily housing developments throughout the state. We were formed in 1990 under the leadership of the Oregon Bankers Association, and we currently administer about $200 million worth of loan capital throughout our various programs. We've funded over 200 affordable housing apartment projects around the state. That's over 9,500 units. And that those projects have leveraged over $1.2 billion of investments in Oregon communities. So affordable housing is actually quite an economic stimulus throughout the state. And 86% of the projects that NOAA has financed has used this particular tax credit since the beginning, which is emphasizes the importance of the resource to our ability to provide affordable housing. We certainly would urge your support of House Bill 2070 and also with the bill that's pending that will increase the cap to this important resource. Even though sunset is a few years away, affordable housing projects, because of the complex financing packages, take 2 to 4 years to develop. And so it's very important for the development community and funders and for Oregon Housing Community Services for their planning purposes to know that the resource will be available by the time the projects are ready to go into construction. The OHTC is one of the few resources, and it's a very successful and powerful tool to help developers create and preserve housing that's affordable to low-income households. It's a resource that's been used throughout the state, and we're pleased to point out that over 41% of the projects are developed in what we consider non-urban communities. So we have a really good track record, and the department deserves great credit for getting this resource deployed throughout the state. There's a map that shows where those projects have been deployed in OLIS, and I encourage you to take a look at that and see that graphically. So Chris did a great job explaining just the high level nuts and bolts of it. I'll go through in just a touch more detail. It's a state income tax credit that benefits low-income renters. It's different than most tax credits in that it's not sold and discounted to investors. It allows banks to reduce their interest rate on loans for affordable housing by up to 4% for a 20-year period. And they claim a state income tax credit equal to the lost interest income from that lower rate. And in most cases, the property owners must agree to pass through all of those interest savings directly to tenants in these projects in the form of lower rents. So I had a handout distributed, and on that is an example. And in that example, you'll see how the project would come together and the impact from it. In without the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, a bank would make a loan possibly at 5.5%, and you would see the rents would be affordable to a group of households earning 60% of what the area median income would be in that community. If we're able to use the credit, then the bank can lower their interest rate to 1.5%. Because that interest rate is lower, the rents can be lower, and the project can still pay back their loan. And that's the mechanical change in how that project, how this credit results in lower rents. Further down on the example, you'll see sort of the other analysis of this, and that's if we had wanted to achieve those same lower rents, but at the market rate of interest if we did not have this credit. And you can see that that project can generate far less income, can support far less debt. And so there will be a large funding gap that would be required to be filled. And so, and if we wanted to serve that same level of household without this credit, then we would need to come up with one-time capital infusions, in this example, of $660,000 in order to get that project built. So it provides a great leveraging resource, and it takes that and pushes it out over a 20-year period so we can get more housing built today. The tax credit is it's very efficient in that it overlays other existing subsidies that come in, so the compliance costs are minimal. It's not discounted and sold to an investor, as I mentioned previously. And the benefit of that is then, because there's no discounting, all of the foregone revenue goes to achieve a public policy purpose in the form of lower rents directly to the households. And that's important. There's two statutory exceptions that Chris pointed out about the pass-through requirements: preservation properties with federal rent subsidies and manufactured home parks do not pass through the lower rents, but they can benefit from this, and it's for various reasons. We can get into those at any time if you'd like, but essentially, the power of this program then does allow us to bring more private capital in to support these projects, and it lessens that gap money that the state needs to provide to that group of projects, which are very high target projects for affordable housing developers. So in short, who benefits from the program? It's tenants. The developers and the lenders receive no direct financial benefit out of this program. Developers get their benefit by being able to meet the needs of lower income households in their communities. And banks are kept whole with their loans, and they benefit from having lending opportunities that support requirements under the Community Reinvestment Act, and also by supporting projects in their own communities. The program provides significant leverage of private capital. Every $1 million of tax credit allocated results in $25 million of private debt. In our experience, that $25 million of private debt generates project developments of equal to $75 to $100 million of development activity. And then if you take the $1 million of the tax credit, leading up to almost $100 million of economic activity and 20 years of lower rents that come from it, it's a pretty powerful program. Phil, we need...
Is this all of this in your testimony?
It is.
And so I know we're at time, and yep. I want to leave enough time, and I recognize some people may have appointments to go to, but if any of you can stay, you're a great resource on this, so good face to a name.
And I am
good
finished.
Testimony. Thank you. Thank you so much. So please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, Madam Speaker, and Committee, thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Jessica Woodruff. I work for REACH Community Development. I will keep it brief so there's time for questions. REACH is a nonprofit affordable housing developer, owner, and operator of about 2,200 affordable units in Multnomah County, Washington County, and Clark County in Washington State. So really I wanted to just explain why we use this tool, the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. So the main tool we use to develop affordable housing is the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, which was designed to serve people making 60% area median income. But what we find in both the community needs where we serve by data and by the people that we are already serving in our housing, that many people at that level still have rent burden. So even the 60% rents are a challenge for many people in the community. So we use this tool whenever we have the potential so we can better meet the needs of the community by lowering the rents that we provide to tenants. So what's interesting from my perspective working in both Oregon and Washington is that the community needs are the same. You know, in Portland, Vancouver, Hillsborough, we're seeing the same trends. Of course, it's just right there. We're really one metro area. But Washington State has no similar tool. So it really shows the power for us that we're able to better meet the needs of the community with this tool for us, which is really simple. When we apply for tax credits to Oregon Housing Community Service, we just request this credit for this purpose to lower the rents, and if we are awarded it, we work with NOAA to get the debt. So it's a pretty simple thing. It's just really an add-on for us to better meet the need. So then, again, just to be quick, I just wanted to say some of the types of projects we've used it on to show also how flexible it is. We've used it for senior housing, workforce, veterans at risk of homelessness, new construction, rehab, and to kind of add on to what we've already talked about today, it's an extremely powerful tool for preservation of 100% Section 8 projects. And we have used that in the last 8 years on 3 projects. And due to the way that we're allowed to use this credit on those projects, it's really meaningful. So, thank you.
Thank you so much. Any questions?
Madam Chair, sorry.
Yes.
I know we're on a tight timeline here. Just a quick question. What happens after the 20 years of the properties? What is, do they get sold off? What do they leave the affordable housing, you know?
So that's stock? A great question. So for REACH, we have never sold a project. We don't intend to ever sell a project. So in many cases, this tool has a restriction for 20 years against our property, but we're often committing anywhere from 60 to 100 years from the other state level resources that we take or city resources. So it's not going to happen, hopefully, in my career time that we would even be in a point of which that would be something to consider. But as already talked about again today, preservation is so important that we try desperately not to lose our current stock.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Also, from NOAA's perspective, do you know what the portfolio ends up being with the different users?
So, as far as the users of the
program, did a lot of those folks tend to keep these housing stocks in their inventory?
Yes, thank you, Representative Meek. Yes, they do. So these are 20-year credits, and that actually coincides with our 20-year loans, and so those sync up really well. And typically, what you will start, and we're just starting to see this now, after 20 years, projects need, as you just heard on the preservation point, they need to be some recapitalized, and they'll come through then with a different mix of the financing. But yes, almost every one of these projects stays in the affordable portfolio in perpetuity, as long as we have the nonprofits and housing authorities involved.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, great. So we look forward to hearing House Bill 2070 and 2852, see in what ways it might be tweaked, or why the cap should be expanded. So we'll look forward to more discussion on this as a good intro to it, and I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2070 and close our Human Services and Housing Committee hearing today. Thank you. Human Services and Housing Committee hearing today. Thank you.